I did second trimester abortions, which is horrific. But I had to say, how do you do a third trimester abortion? Like, if that's true, how do you get a baby that size out?
Welcome to another episode of Dear Jane. I'm Marcy. This is Scott. But you guys know that already. You've heard us many times introduce ourselves. I am very excited about today's episode and the conversation we're having because of a few things. First, we talk about abortion, we meaning the broader culture, without really understanding what abortion is. And today you are going to hear facts and easy to understand evidence about what abortion actually is that hopefully equips you for the conversations you're having. Two, I'm excited because you're going to get to hear about exciting pro-life work that's happening even in desolate states like the state that I currently reside in, Colorado.
Well, I'm especially challenged by today's episode because normally I'm the smartest one on the podcast. But today, Dr. Wheeler gives me a run for the money. She is brilliant, and I love the way she talks about the issue.
Well, I think you did a good job for being runner-up, Scott. I'll give you that position. Without further ado, we want to get past all of our silliness into the meat of this conversation. We are joined today by Dr. Catherine Wheeler. She is a board member for the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYN. She helps run the Colorado chapter here, and you're just going to love hearing from her. So without further ado, Dr. Wheeler. Dr. Wheeler, thank you so much for joining us today on Dear Jane. We're excited to get into this conversation with you. Some people may have heard you speak at the March for Life or other events. Can you just start us off by telling us some of your story?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate what you guys do. So I am an OBGYN physician. I practiced for 24 years. I live in Colorado now, but I was actually practicing in Salt Lake City, Utah. And I actually, as part of my training and early practice, I did abortions on babies with special needs. So that was part of my background. I obviously have become pro-life, which has been a long and late journey, and have become very actively involved.
So tell us about when you became pro-life. You decided to sort of make a major career change. What led to that?
Well, I don't say that I really became pro-life. You know, there's stages often. People often become pro-life over time. You know, for me, I was not a Christian at the time when I decided to do abortions. I had the option of whether to do them or not. Now it's harder for residents to not do them. But at the time, we had to opt in. And again, these were on babies with special needs mostly, but I did one so-called elective abortion in a 16-year-old, which was something I had decided I wouldn't do, but I allowed myself to be convinced. What you need to know about most abortionists is they actually have incredible compassion for what these women are going through, but haven't thought through the issue clearly and have picked up the narrative that we help women by doing abortions. And so I went in to do an abortion one day, and with really nothing strange happening in the room, it was a sudden blinders off awareness of the baby and of the dark evil. I can tell you there was, you know, just starting an abortion, all of a sudden, everything just went black in the room to me, which at the time, you know, looking around, because it was obviously very strange and realizing nobody else is experiencing anything unusual, and being very aware of this being evil, that I was about to kill a baby. And it was the first time I ever had that thought. It was the first time I ever actually saw the baby that I was about to kill. And so I ended up, because I'd started, having to make a decision. Do I stop? You know, how do I stop? What happens to her? And I decided to finish in that moment, which is kind of a strange choice, but that's what I decided. Again, as a non-Christian, I didn't have any framing for how what to do with that awareness of evil and the fact that I'd killed a baby and had killed before that. And so I just kind of shut it out. So for me, it was an awareness, a sudden awareness, which I couldn't explain at the time. For other abortionists, it's something else. But then you have to come to the thinking process that gradually brings you to being pro-life. And that involves just dealing with all of the lies that you believed and the justifications one by one, and really looking at the evidence and having to face reality. And so it was a long process to become fully pro-life.
You said something really interesting that I think a lot of people don't realize, which is that a lot of the doctors who perform abortions think that they are being compassionate to women. I think, you know, the generalization of these doctors is they're just in it for the money, they don't care, they're heartless. Can you speak more to that? And kind of, I also can identify with that feeling of maybe for a lot of them feeling trapped, like they're just, they're in it now. But can you say more about that?
Yeah, you know, you go into medicine and you really go into it because you want to help people. But a lot of people who go into medicine are very compliant people too. And so you're learning medicine, you know, what is medicine? What do we normally do? And so there's been a lot of work by the abortion industry and advocacy, and unfortunately, medical organizations, to make this a so-called normal essential part of reproductive health care, which it's not. The majority of OBGYNs practice without doing abortions. In fact, 87 to 93% of them. And once I quit doing abortions, I never had a need to do an abortion. Women don't need abortion. Even in life-threatening circumstances, they don't need to have their baby directly killed, although sometimes we have to deliver them. So, you know, most of them look at it, if you have not rationally thought about what abortion is, you literally, it's kind of a grooming. That's all I can think of it looking back. Because, of course, you ask yourself, how in the world did I ever do something as awful as that? And, you know, there's part of never thinking about it and part really being groomed and indoctrinated into it. And you really do care deeply about the women. You feel horrible about the situations they're in. And so you ignore the baby. Like, you don't even discount it. You don't even just say, well, the baby doesn't matter. You actually literally put on blinders and don't let yourself think about the baby. I don't know how else to explain it. That's the best I can do. But most of us come into this, like, you just feel awful for the situation they're in, and you get the wrong answer when you think abortion's the answer.
So I want to peel back some layers here. So you are a person of faith now, correct? Do I have that correct?
I am now.
Okay. All right. So let's peel that back a little, because a lot of people on the other side will say, oh, okay, it's a religious thing. That's why she came to that conclusion. But you come at it from a very evidence-based, you know, scientific. Help us get those to jibe a little bit and talk more about how it's not a faith thing necessarily. That's not your primary motivation. Sort of talk about the scientific backup.
Yeah, you know, I'll say my faith allows me to talk about it, because I wouldn't, you know, when you've done horrible things, and we've all done horrible things, how do you ever stand up and say, I did this awful thing, unless you know you're forgiven and still loved? So that's how my faith helps me. But for me, it was actually realizing that I had to ignore the baby in order to do these. And that came about from actually, for the first time, dealing with two babies I lost to miscarriage. And as I thought about that, I was a new Christian, and, you know, the thought that actually these babies had souls and that I would see them in heaven. And, like, I had never considered that when you lost a baby early in pregnancy, because I'd seen their heartbeats, you know, I knew that they were there. And so I'd never really grieved that. And in grieving it and realizing I would see them, I literally heard God tell me, you're going to meet those babies that you aborted also. Yeah, which is like horrifying, but immediately followed by, and they love you. And so it's that awareness of the baby, that they're actually just as valuable as the babies who are wanted and normal. You know, there's no difference. What makes wanted or unwanted, or normal or unnormal, the basis of whether or not we have value? We understand that after birth, but we know from science these babies exist from the very second of sperm egg fusion. So, and I did too. So once you let yourself think about the scientific reality of that, you realize that actually we're talking about human beings from that very first fraction of a second.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. What was the timeline or the journey for you from performing abortions to saying, no, I don't want to do this anymore, to then getting involved in pro-life work? Was that an immediate thing? Was that a journey for you? Talk to us a little bit about that.
It was a long journey. It was probably about 15 years from my last abortion. And again, I didn't let myself ever think about it again. I just walled it off, kind of like a trauma response. And then I became a Christian in my early 50s, which started me in a process where I knew that I was safe to start thinking about it and to start processing what I'd done. And then moving into confronting all of those misconceptions and lies and justifications took about 5 more years, and it took some moves. So my practice ended about 2015. I moved to help family members in different places, and one of those, I started actually helping at a pregnancy resource center, which was my first introduction. Like, I wasn't going to do it because I'd heard all about them and from ACOG and other places. And I walked in, I'm like, oh my gosh, they were lying to me about pregnancy resource centers. They actually tell the whole truth, don't coerce women, stand by women, are very loving, very judgmental, stay by their side no matter what they choose. So that to me was the beginning of really deeply processing this. And then I moved to Colorado, which opened a whole new door of what abortion really is about. And I still had a little bit of a dividing line around viability. And then I moved here right when there was a proposition about ending abortion after a baby can survive outside the womb. And I thought, well, everybody can understand that. That's no-brainer. Like, does it even happen? I had to look it up first. Does it really happen? Oh, yeah, at least, more than one baby a day in Colorado. And secondly, I did second trimester abortions, which is horrific. But I had to say, how do you do a third trimester abortion? Like, if that's true, how do you get a baby that size out? And so I looked that up, and oh, man, I recommend people do it because you should know. But that was enough to start inducing me to talking. So that was probably my last line to go away that I had to deal with. Thank you, Colorado.
Yeah, I'm having to be careful what I say about Colorado because I have two Colorado women here. So I'll be very, very straight and narrow. You referenced this earlier, but I'm kind of curious. You talked about how OBGYNs now, do they feel pressured to provide abortions, or sort of help us understand what is brought to bear on them in that world?
Yeah, you know, I think to back up a little bit about, part of my journey has been learning about the Holocaust and the Nazi doctors. Because to me, I know they don't want us to talk about it, but I have to, because it's really very similar to the devaluing of human beings that allows us to take their lives. And so as part of that, I've read quite a bit about it, including police forces who were used by the Nazis to kill huge numbers of Jews into pits. And, you know, how do ordinary people do that? Because these were mostly, like us doctors, mostly ordinary, compassionate people who live normal lives. And this applies to residency. Most of us will do what we think we're expected to do, which is the horribly sad part of that. So if you make it normal, and if you're in a hierarchical position, which definitely medical training is very hierarchical, just like the military, these people control where you go after, if you do a fellowship, what your evaluations are. So I got to opt in. At the time they understood conscious objections, it was up to us to decide if we wanted to. Now they actually have to opt out. They have to go to their superiors and say, I have a conscience objection, I will not do this. It may have a huge impact on their career, where they can get a job, whether they get a fellowship, whether they can finish their program well.
You can be blacklisted or something like that?
Well, you know, imagine going to your superior and saying, no, I won't do something that you think is a good thing. It could have all kinds of implications.
Wow. Talk to us about what you do now. So you are a board member for, I'm always nervous, I'm going to get this wrong, but American Association for Pro-Life OBGYNs. Is that it?
Yes.
Tell us about that work and then some of what you're doing here in Colorado.
Yes, thank you. So we actually got to start the first chapter of the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs right here in Colorado. Colorado, I truly believe, is a leader for life. We just haven't walked into our destiny yet. So as part, what APLOG does is not just OBGYNs, it's any medical professional or even associate who just wants to be part of it. And they're really the secular preeminent medical voice, evidence-based voice for life. And about the harms for women with abortion. So we've been able to bring that into Colorado, which is really exciting. We knew we needed it because when you go to the legislature, all of the other organizations stand up under the authority of a national organization. So we've got Planned Parenthood, who's always here. We've got ACOG, who's often here, the American College of OBGYN, among others. And so we approached APLOG and said, you know, we really need the authority and resources of a national organization. And they actually have been thinking about it, and so put some trust in us, which we're very thankful for. What we do is we work with community. People who are pro-life, especially in states like Colorado, need community. Mm-hmm. They need resources. They need connection. They need to know somebody has their back. We also equip them to be the medical voice in Colorado for truth and for life. We work with the next generation. It's really key so that people like me don't go in completely unprepared for what they're going to hear and get manipulated into doing abortions or choose to do them. So we work with the next generation. We're involved with the media. We're trying to educate the public and the media. And one of our really big goals is really promoting life-affirming, excellent healthcare for women in Colorado. So moving to that next space of filling the gaps that all this focus on abortion has left women abandoned and without excellent care.
So it seems important to have that kind of support group in place, whether an informal support group or actually resources available. I mean, I'm thinking about the ramifications for an OBGYN who decides to opt out, as you said. Could they lose their job over that potentially?
Do you know, it's possible. I know of people here in Colorado who, one of them works in the midst of a place where she's the only one who's not involved with abortion. Like, what a hard place to be. It was the opposite place for me. And so it's a very hostile environment. They may say you can't work here, you can't have a job if you don't do abortions. There's a push for removing conscience objections, because one of the biggest barriers, according to the abortion industry and American College of OBGYN, is that not enough OBGYNs will agree to take the lives of babies or do abortions, which is what they would say. But again, only 87 to 93% of us won't do it. So we're one of the biggest barriers. So they're trying to take away our conscience objections. So, yeah, there are a lot of ramifications. You may not get a job wherever your fellow, like if you're going to go on with a fellowship, so the next level of training, you may not be able to get a fellowship without your superiors giving you recommendations.
Have you experienced or might someone, an OBGYN who does this, experience like some sort of, I mean, I'm sure you've been criticized. The other side tries to, downplay your qualifications or something like that. I mean, is that as bad as I think it probably is?
Do you know, I try to reach out to people on the other side because my heart goes out to them. They don't realize what they're doing. I mean, I look back, I'm horrified at what I've done. And, you know, I remember parts of it and as much as I let myself, I know that they're going to come to their moment too of realization. And my heart goes out for them to know that there are people who still care and that Jesus actually forgives them. That's the big part of my heart. As far as how they deal with me, most of the time they don't want anything to do with me. I try to reach out and say, hey, I'm an ex-abortionist and you know I'd love to talk with you. And usually it's the cold soul. I mean, I've had kind of aggressive approaches from it. But I want them to know that they're acceptable to me, that I understand and that there's a different way.
Of course, Colorado isn't alone in fighting some of the state battles when it comes to life issues. If The battles have not come to your state yet. They will. And if they do, you need to contact Cogency Strategic. They can help you win your campaign for life. They can help with messaging, make sure it gets to the right people. And they can do it in ways that no one else can in the pro-life movement. So you need to check them out, CogencyStrategic.com.
When you show up to testify, because I know you've testified a lot, the Colorado legislators here give us a lot to testify against. For anyone who likes to follow Colorado politics, when you show up to testify, do the legislators, do they just write off your testimony, even though you are a former abortionist? Like, what? I know a lot of them just sit there and they're on their phones and they're not paying attention to anyone, but what kind of responses do you get when you show up and you present scientific, fact-based evidence to, you know, discuss their bill? How do they just dismiss what you have to say? What's their reaction?
Yeah, it's been an interesting process. I was involved in Utah, too, so I was surprised when I moved here on how disrespectful they are. And you're right, a lot of them are on their phones. The first time I testified was against, can't remember if it was Prop 115 or I think it was Reproductive Health Equity Act. It was the first time. It was when I had first started to speak about it. And, you know, honestly, it was very difficult. It would take me days to recover because it's hard to stand up and to say that. But I remember the first time Stephanie Luck, Representative Luck, asking me to describe, since you've done second trimester abortions, will you please describe exactly what you did? And they all stopped. It went silent. Everybody listened, and I wept during it. I mean, it's hard to say that the first time in a public space. And I say, as you do it more, I think it's important to do. You can't just let the evil and the lies stand. You have to stand up and speak truth. We have to step into these spaces. So they discount me more and more now. I find in personal conversations, once people know that I've done abortions, they often have questions or they'll open up with things that they're thinking about. You know, I think the trick is to be non-confrontational, to hear their story, to let them know why I did that and what the truth is behind it. And I think they see that I'm not being condemning. I'm just trying to help people to understand what's actually true.
You've kind of referenced now a couple times, both verbally and visually, people need to know the truth about, I mean, they just need to see it and believe it and to understand it. And I know that's an ongoing sort of tension within the pro-life movement of how much do we really want to show, or what's the impact? But there is evidence that show that that can change hearts and minds, especially of people in the middle. What is a good utilization of that reality, and how would it be good to use to help people understand the truth about abortion?
Yeah, you know, that takes a lot of wisdom. Like I would, in that situation, pray whether this is wise or not, because if, you know, when I was early in the pro-life movement, I remember one time in Spokane, happened to be walking downtown, and there was somebody yelling with his pictures, and just, oh man, just being so cruel. And I'm like, seriously, where's your heart? You know? And so, like, when I'm talking to people, if I think it's going to be helpful, I often will say, well, do you know what abortion is? Because we do all kinds of things to actually not talk about what abortion is. It's kind of like saying, I don't know, you could substitute any word for it and people would have no idea. I could say, you know, I went to hug a puppy today. I don't know. It just sounds so benign and sweet to people. Oh, it's a good thing. You know, so I just say, do you understand what abortion is? And I'm actually an ex-abortionist. Is it okay if I tell you what happens? And then they almost always say yes, but I try to be very sensitive because there are people who are unhealed. And what we don't want to do is crush them. Because, you know, if we condemn them or crush them, it could put them over the edge. Mm-hmm. Our goal is to save lives, including their lives. So I just think it takes a lot of wisdom. If I'm going to talk, I try to remember, if I'm going to be showing pictures or describing in detail, give people an out. Look, I'm going to explain the reality of abortion, and I want you to know you can step out for any reason. Go to the bathroom if you want to. But, feel like you can step out if you need to. So I do think we need to give people the out and be incredibly sensitive about how we do that. Not that we're hiding what it is, but there are people that we could completely crush if we're not careful.
Well, unfortunately, this is an issue that has impacted probably more people than we realize. I think especially with the easy access to the abortion pill nowadays, that's, you know, we're still finding out about all the ways women are traumatized by taking the abortion pill and going through abortions that way. So it's, you're right. You never know who you're talking to and what their story is and how they may have been affected by abortion. Kind of speaking of the abortion pill, and I was thinking about what you said about most people have no idea what abortion is. I think that's true of a lot of the things we talk about in the abortion discussion. Nobody knows what they're actually talking about. One of the things that was recently banned in Colorado a couple of years ago, and other states are moving to do this as well, is abortion pill reversal. But I think in order for people to understand how the reversal works, they kind of need to understand how the abortion pill works. Can you kind of describe that for us, or just explain maybe the mechanics of the abortion pill and then how the reversal process works?
Yeah, thank you. So about 2/3 of abortions in the United States now are done by chemicals, by medications. And so there are two drugs that are involved. They're actually approved by the FDA only until 10 weeks of pregnancy, although we know they're being used off-label much higher. So the first drug is called mifepristone, or RU486. And it blocks, actually attaches to the receptor that progesterone works through. Now, progesterone is an essential hormone in early pregnancy that keeps the pregnancy growing. It maintains the uterine lining and placenta interface. So all of the baby's nutrients and oxygen come through that. So if you block the progesterone receptor, progesterone can attach and work, and so you have a breakdown of that interface, meaning that the baby almost always dies. And then the second drug is called misoprostol. It's a prostaglandin, which causes uterine contractions, essentially like labor, which expels the dead baby. And they usually take that 1 to 2 days after the mifepristone. So that's what the process is. Now, the way that the abortion pill reversal works, it's actually natural progesterone. And we know from pharmacology and biology that this attachment of mifepristone to the receptor is reversible. So if you put large amounts of natural progesterone into the woman's system, it can unbind, the progesterone can bind again and have its action. And so 2/3 of the time, you can save that baby as long as she takes it within 72 hours and has not taken the second drug to cause labor. So it's actually very, very effective. The abortion industry doesn't like it because it destroys the narrative that women regret abortions. It's my take on it. Because that's a big narrative. And so they say, actually, you're shaming women by suggesting that they might want to change their minds. You know, the other way to think of that is you've got this chance that the baby could be 2/3 chance that if she changes her mind, you could save a life. We're talking about death and life. Right. So it is very effective, and so it's not surprising that they want to make it illegal.
You just answered the question I was going to ask you, because one of the things I've never understood is, you know, the other side, they say they're about choice. We know that they're driven by money. Once they take that first pill, I mean, their money has been paid, that sort of thing. So what are they out if somebody takes an abortion reversal pill? If they still got what they wanted, so why are they so vehemently against it? And I think you're on to something with it. It totally destroys that narrative that women have abortion, could care less. There's no harm, there's no risk, all that nonsense that we hear. I think that you're on to something there. You know what? Not that you needed me to affirm you, Dr. Wheeler, but I think you're pretty smart.
Well, I don't know. It came from somebody else, too. I do think it's the same reason for the attacks against pregnancy resource centers. Again, you know, why would women need resources? Women can make up their own minds. Well, we know that the majority of them are doing it because they're abandoned and afraid, and a very large number are coerced. The majority would have made a different choice if somebody had helped them. They know that. So, yeah, that's the same reason for the attack.
It's interesting that in them doing all of this to try to protect their narrative that women don't regret abortions, they're contradicting the narrative that they're for choice.
Right.
Because abortion pill reversal offers women a choice. And like you said, it's not effective 100% of the time, but in 2/3 of the cases, it's effective. And I remember when the state legislature was passing that, and I just thought, they're taking away a woman's right to change her mind. And if I can make a joke about women, that's what we do. We change our minds about things. And it's astounding that they can take something that's so scientific and so biological and say, no, that's ridiculous. I remember seeing women show up to testify against the bill with their babies who had been born because of abortion pill reversal, and the legislators just turned a blind eye. It's really incredible.
Yeah, and it's for that reason. You know, there are two judgments here. You know, what they said is it's off-label use, meaning the FDA has approved it for safety, and we've used it over 50 years. I used it a lot in my patients with threatened miscarriage, fertility management. We've used it for a long time. We know it's safe. But, you know, also they said, well, it's off label, meaning that the FDA not only approves for safety, but approves for specific indications for that drug. And it turns out the majority of our drugs in the United States, we're using off label. We know they work, but it's so expensive to get it approved for indications that we go based on scientific evidence. They use mifepristone and misoprostol off-label all the time, but somehow that's a different standard.
Right.
And we know that progesterone is incredibly safe, and we know the complications of mifepristone, which is at least 1 in 5 when used before 7 weeks of pregnancy, 1 in 5 has a complication. So, yeah, two different standards.
What did you say, Marcy? The IQ of today's episode has increased. The IQ of Dear Jane today has increased like 20-fold, something like that.
Certainly.
You know, the question I really want to ask you, Dr. Wheeler, is the next time you're on stage talking to tens of thousands of people, like you were at the March for Life, you give a little shout out to Scott and Marcy or some sort of, you know, tug and just, you know, hey, yeah, that would be great.
You reach out to March for Life and ask if I can talk again then.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you so much for being on with us today, Dr. Wheeler. I love hearing your perspective as an OBGYN, someone who has firsthand knowledge of abortion, and I never get tired of hearing your story and hearing about the work that you're doing today. And as someone else who lives in Colorado, I'm grateful for the work that you do to fight against the craziness. If people want to learn more about APLOG and the work that you do, and maybe even how to get involved with that in Colorado, where can they go?
Yeah, go to aaplog.org. You can reach me through there. You can look at the great work. You actually don't have to be a medical professional to join. You can see all of the evidence, all the resources for free. So I'd encourage everybody to go to that site. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Yep. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks again for listening to Dear Jane.
You can follow along every day on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and X. And make sure you also are subscribed so you never miss an episode on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. Ring that bell so you're notified and you never miss an episode.